Episode 31, Tom Chapin. Here we go. This is a special episode for me. When I was 5 years old, I had a VHS of Tom live in concert that I was so obsessed with, I literally wore it out. I broke it from watching it too many times. My first concert was Tom Chapin at Toys R Us. I mean, the crazy thing about Tom's music is it's children's music or it's kids' music, and I still listen to it today. Like, every now and then, I'll pull it up on Spotify and I'll listen to it, and I go, man, he's so good. He's genius. The music is incredible. The songwriting is incredible. His music just brings me joy. It's brilliant. And but here's the thing. If you didn't grow up listening to Tom's music, like probably most of you listening, you're still going to get something out of this episode. First of all, Tom is the brother of legendary singer-songwriter Harry Chapin. And actually, Harry has a new documentary out called When in Doubt, Do Something. You can check it out online. It's an amazing film. And we talk all about Harry. There's some amazing stories about him. But also, this is an episode about songwriting. This is about performance. This is about the history of folk music. We cover so much ground in this episode. And I think even if you didn't grow up listening to Tom, you're going to learn a couple things about music history and you're going to get some insight. And I think you're really going to like this. So here we go. Episode 31. This means a lot to me. This is probably the most nervous I've been for any podcast recording because Tom is someone I looked up to when I was 5 years old. And it's weird how you still look up to these people, even when you're, you know, much older, you still kind of idolize the people you did when you were really young. It's a weird thing. But here we go. Episode 31, Tom Chapin. Let's dive in. Well, the first thing I want to say is I've been listening to your music since I was 4 years old, 5 years old. I picked up a guitar and I would watch your, I had a VHS of yours and I would watch your hands. And I would play guitar along to your hands. And my guitar was missing strings. Eventually, I got a real guitar. And then my guitar teacher would put stickers on the guitar where my fingers were supposed to go. Tom Chapin songs. So I've been listening to you since then. I now live in Nashville, for better or worse. Now I work in the music industry thanks to Tom Chapin. I wouldn't have it any other way.
And what are you doing these days? What are you doing in the music industry?
So I work more on the business side, actually. But I play guitar every single day. I've got my guitars over here and I still do recording sessions. And every now and then I pick up a guitar and I pick out a Tom Chapin song. I promise. Because it's funny how your music reminds me of the excitement of why I wanted to go into music. And there's other bands that do that also. Like the Beatles do that for me and AC/DC does that for me. And there's a lot of, but your music is an example of music that I'll go back to remind me why I wanted to play music in the first place, and it's so cool to me.
Cool, you know. Well, the whole idea, especially for the kids' side, for the family music, was to make it joyful, you know, and fun for grown-ups as well as kids. And because early on they wanted me, you know, I was doing Make a Wish, and people said you should do a children's record, and my idea of a kids' record was you know, Three Little Duckies or something, you know, was Raffi or and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Pete Seeger and stuff, which was all for like two, three, four-year-olds. And then my kids were 8 and 6, and I suddenly realized, man, you know, there's no music for this age, really.
Right.
And this age can understand, you know, story and humor, and you know, it doesn't have to be dumb, you know, or not dumb, or so simple. And the whole idea was to try to come up with some recordings that parents could play in the car with their kids and not go crazy, you know. And so it's lovely to hear when I, you know, somebody who grew up with it, that it stayed with them. Because we, me and my collaborators, really enjoyed making these records and enjoyed writing. And we're very tough on ourselves about what made it in, you know.
So absolutely. And I'll tell you one last thing before we dive in. Is sometimes I have two siblings, my brother's 10 years older than me, my sister's older than me, and sometimes if we're in the car and we can't decide what to listen to, my parents will say, let's just put on the Tom Chapin album. And we'll still occasionally, and we're like, you know, 20, 30-year-olds listening to Tom Chapin, and we still love it. But I'm really curious, because I started doing a ton of research, and probably the most fun fact that I learned was that you were in this movie, Blue Water, White Death, in the early 70s.
Yep.
And this amazed me. They're shooting a movie on great white sharks and they go, man, You know, we need a folk singer on this ship.
It didn't happen that way. Let's do this thing. I'm going to tell you the story. Go ahead.
How's it happen?
Are we on now, or is this just? Or just
oh, we're on. We're on. We've been on the whole time.
Oh, great. Okay, good. So my brother Harry was in and out of Cornell University, and every time he flunked out, he'd go and talk to my uncle Ricky. Ricky was the Ricky Leacock of Leacock Pennybaker, who did Monterey Pops, the fabulous, great, very well-known documentary filmmakers in New York City. He was British. And he'd give Harry a job doing something, and Harry got better and better at it. In fact, Harry later on made a film called Legendary Champions, which was nominated for Academy Award as the best documentary. And just before he got back into music. So I'm playing tennis with Harry and this guy, Jim Lipscomb, who was a great documentary filmmaker himself, up in Tarrytown. And I'm living in Brooklyn. And we get on the train, meet at Grand Central. We're going on the train, and Jim starts telling Harry, I'm going to be doing this film on great white sharks. I'm going to Indian Ocean for 6 months, and we're going to film the thing. No one's ever filmed the great white shark underwater, and he's telling us the whole thing. And Harry's going, well, I can't do that. And I'm going, I can. I just graduated college. I've been out of school for a year or two. And eventually it worked out that I was hired as sound man and assistant diver, although I never got in the water. And so we get I got to go on as the sound man. And Jim, who was a fan of Harry's and mine and great friend of Harry's, a great friend of mine, he decided, as a documentary filmmaker does, he says, I brought my guitar along, you know, and he says, so he had me sing. He said, well, here, sit up here, just sing one of the songs, sing us. And so I did a bunch of songs that he just, on down times, which became the soundtrack to the movie. And
right.
They had no idea who I was. Peter Gimbel and Stan Waterman and all the divers, we became great friends, but they had no idea I was a musician at all. But I would sing at night. Ron and Valerie Taylor, it was an amazing thing for me. We went to the Indian Ocean, didn't find any great white sharks, found million sharks, but no great whites, and followed a whaling trip. And I mean, it's actually on DVD now. You should see it. It's an amazing film. It's the first time Peter Gimbel invented the shark cages, which everybody uses now, but no one had used until then.
They were invented for that movie?
Yeah. Peter invented them. The idea, how can we get in the water with the sharks? And then he said, well, I wonder if there's a way we can get a floating cage to go up and down, and he worked out how to do it. So that was the first time it was used.
That movie kind of inspired Jaws. Like that's kind of like, and that's like an important film, right?
Well, Stan Waterman, who was one of the divers, lived in Princeton, as did, I can't think of his name now, the guy who wrote Jaws, the book. So it absolutely inspired him because you talk about the great white shark, which is this, other than the orcas is the premier predator in the ocean, and they grow to 15, 18 feet and thousands of pounds. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing animal, and really related to Carcharian carcharius, which is the great white shark back in dinosaur age. That's how old they are.
Right.
And so, what's his name? Whoever wrote Jaws would come and have dinner with Stan, and they'd talk about all this stuff. And that kind of was like, oh, that'd be an interesting horror film, trying to catch this shark. And then that became Jaws.
And the footage, because I was watching little clips of it, the footage is actually amazing. It looks like it could have been done last year. Like, it still looks really great.
Well, it was an astonishing thing. It was cinema. It was a wide cinema. It was done in 35 millimeter. Jim had a big camera with a blimp to hold the sound, and I 55 pounds. I pick it up and put it on his shoulder. He was 6'2", strong man. I'm 6'5", and I pick it up, put it on his shoulder. He said, "Give me f-stop, so and so," and then we click it up. And then I plug into him, and I had a Nagra, and I just carry it. And I came back like beefy, man. I was a skinny guy, basketball player, and I come back. And I weighed, gained about 10 pounds of. My arms are like this. It was an amazing event to watch this happen and be on pretty part of it. At the end, they never filmed the great white shark for the 6 months I was there, but they came home and they had this incredible film, and they said, we need an ending. We have to go back to And everybody said, well, go to Australia. Ron and Valerie Taylor were Australians. And they said, right on Dangerous Reef in Australia, that's where they are. So they got more money and they went back and they asked me to go. And I said, no, one of the things I learned on that trip was watching these guys who were all in their 50s, 40s and 50s, who had changed their, had made, just decided to follow their bliss, follow their dream. Peter Gimbel is was one of the Gimbel families. You know, the Gimbel, the department store.
Right.
He and his twin brother were on Wall Street making zillions of dollars. And he was in his late 30s, I think, and his brother died of a heart attack. And he said, and Peter goes, what am I doing here? What do I want to do? And so he started trying to do films about, he did a film about the Weddell Seal, W-E-D-D-E-L, which is a big, the seals that are in up in Antarctica and underwater. And then he decided to do the Great White Shark, and he raised the money, and then he got the best divers in the world, Stan Waterman, Ron and Valerie Taylor, and that became the that was the film. And then he hired Jim Lipscomb to be the shore guy, and so but it was watching these guys that they'd all made these choices to not just go the easy route, but what do I want to do with my life. And so I was, when I came home, I really wanted to get back in music, just to do music. You know, I didn't really want to go out and spend my life, you know, like this and doing sound, or and then coming home and sitting on not a computer, but on a, you know, on a machine. And it didn't interest me, but music did. So that's when I really decided that's my life, you know.
That's an incredible story. So I was realizing, looking back, that I think we both kind of, I mean, like I said, I grew up kind of playing along to your music. And then when I was in college, I was studying with Woody Mann, who was a disciple of the great Reverend Davis. And he was teaching me every Reverend Gary Davis song, Under the Sun, which I'm kind of grateful for. And then I realized looking back that you grew up, did you ever take lessons from him, or would you just play along to his records?
I went to Brooklyn Tech with my brother Harry and my brother Steve. And, When I was there, my last year there, earlier, my second year, Harry was out of school, but we started a folk music club at Brooklyn Tech, all boys. And it was 6,000 boys in Brooklyn Tech. And one of the guys who was there was Stefan Grossman, who is also like Woody Mann, but he's written a jillion books about all the great black fingerstyle guitarists. So he was taking lessons from Reverend Gary Davis. He's telling us a story. So one day, he takes, and Harry came in, Harry was in college, but he came home for, you know, Thanksgiving early or something. And we talked, Stefan said, sure, I'll take you up there. So we jumped on the subway and from Brooklyn and went all the way up to Harlem and walked along Harlem. It was kind of a dangerous place at that point.
And I've heard from Woody about how crazy it was to go over to his house.
And there was a big, you know, there was these giant, beautiful apartment houses, which were all built for the Jews in the 30s and the 20s.
Right.
And now are all mostly black. And we went down underneath and into the back. And in the backyard, there was this little house with like a one room, two room little house in the backyard of this big complex. And there he was. There was the Reverend. And I sat there and watched Stefan Grossman for $7 getting a lesson for an hour and a half. And he was working on... I should get a guitar, but he's working on trying to get home, trying to get home, and watching him and Reverend just with the two fingers and watch him do it changed my world.
Piedmont style and that
changed that my tone. World, man. It's just like, oh. And then I went home, you know, and I'd heard a couple of records because maybe he's talking about it, and then the record sounded, that can't be one guy.
Right.
You know, because the thumb is but stride piano. That's what it is. Boom, gung, 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 like stride piano with the left hand and the right hand's doing the other stuff. And the thumb is that. Dun, 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 and then the fingers are doing this. But he just had just these two, man. That's what he did. And then he would play. You know the stuff. It's amazing stuff. And so that changed my world. I knew how to finger pick at that point. But you know, like. Freight train.
Right, the old Elizabeth Kahn tune that everyone learns. Yeah, yeah.
And I was using I started playing finger picks right away because Harry played banjo, and he was really loud on the banjo, and I did, I, and I couldn't get the flat pick. I was like, at that time, I was like, this is crazy. So I started getting finger picks and started learning how to finger pick.
That's why you started using finger picks, because you were trying to keep up with Harry's ball.
Yeah, we were I was 12, Harry was 14, Steve was 11, and Steve and I had been choir boys, and also had studied classical instruments. There were four boys, my mother and father. My dad was a jazz drummer, Jim Chapin.
Right, of course. Right, with the famous book, the book that every drummer looks at. Yeah, yeah.
So, and dad, my mom divorced when I was three because dad was on the road, and he loved two things, drums and women. And he was a lovely guy, not a dad. He's like a favorite uncle. You know, he's like, he's doing his thing. But he's the reason we got into music, because he was just a delightful presence in our lives, even though he was out there someplace. And Harry took trumpet, I took clarinet, Steve took piano, but Steve and I, when my mother remarried, we moved to Brooklyn, and Steve and I got in a choir, boys choir. My mother put us into a boys choir. Harry was never in it. So now Harry's 14, I'm 12, Steve's 11. We're out in our country house in Jersey that my grandfather bought, and we spent the summers there. And there was one hi-fi, remember hi-fis in the valley? And that was, actually it was two, but there's one that we could play, and that was at my mother's sister's house. And she brought in the Weavers at Carnegie Hall, recording of 1955 of the Weavers concert, the reunion of the Weavers.
Right.
And it blew our minds. It started out with Darlin' Corey. Pete Seeger just, you know, we had no idea what happened, but it starts out with a banjo. Ding, 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 like this. Starts out. I never forget, he goes like. And the crowd goes crazy because they know the song. Just rocked, and that we go, whoa, guitar, banjo, I guess they had their bass, and four voices, Ronnie Gilbert, that heraldic alto voice that was just wonderful to hear, and three baritones, Pete and Lee Hayes and Fred Hellerman.
And this is pre, like, this Beatles on Ed Sullivan, so this Ed Sullivan moment, kind of.
That was it, and it was summer of 57, maybe summer of 58, I'm not sure which year, and but that recording not only inspired the Chapin boys, but Tom Paxton, Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, on the whole folk thing came from them. And it was, and they're still, in my mind, the best folk group I ever heard. You know, just the arrangements are fabulous. Fred Hellerman was a little bit, had some jazz stuff, and Pete was very amazing on banjo. So we listened to that all summer long, and the summer, Harry goes, we could do that. And he got a guitar. And he got a banjo, and he got a guitar. In fact, I got the banjo here. It was my grandma. We were looking for a five-string banjo, and she goes, "I think I have one. Wait a minute." She goes down and goes in the basement, and she pulls out.
This is the actual
brother,
one.
Harry Forbes had bought around 1910.
Oh my God.
And here it is. And what's it say? It says Josh Ricketts on here, Philadelphia. It's an old timey banjo. And Harry got it fixed up. Nice old timey sounded.
Yeah.
So this is it. This is the banjo. I got it fixed up again up in Beacon at Pete's hometown. The guy who fixed Pete's banjos, J.R. Storm, fixed it up for me. And it's just, I just love it. It's old-timey banjo, 19, around 1900, 19, something like that, before World War One.
So did you ever take like formal lessons, or were you always playing along to records and sort
playing
of
along
you
records,
and Harry were challenging each other?
I took later on, I took some classical lessons, but that was when I was already a professional, just to sort of figure out, get my hands working a little different way. But I didn't. So I then got a K guitar, you know, it was the strings about this far, it hurt my hands. And then my dad took me up to Manny's Music on 48th, the very famous store in New York City.
Of course, yeah,
and
yeah.
My dad, you know, whose book was sold there all the time, and every drummer wanted it.
Was he a big deal? Like when he walked in, did everyone know him? They're like, Jim, hey, Jim.
Henry and Manny's new dad, and they knew my grandma because she was the one who actually on the phone. Do you need more books? She was the one who kept going. But dad would walk in, and I'd walk in with him, and so you know, and oh, who's this? And so I knew Henry and Manny, and our pictures were on the wall there and stuff when we got our first record. Anyway, so Dad bought me an Epiphone guitar, which actually my daughter Abigail is playing now, for like $125 now. It's worth, you know, in the thousands, but it's a really good, great Epiphone Texan. Just when Gibson bought Epiphone, and so it was a Gibson guitar, but it said Epiphone on it. And I took that to Indian Ocean, as a matter of fact, and I played. Anyway, so to make a long story a little shorter, we became the Chapin Brothers. And Steve and I were still in the choir, so our first concert was at the spring choir concert in the gym, and we sang This Land Is Your Land and two other Weaver's songs. And the thing was with the Chapins was that Harry was a good musician, but he had two brothers who could sing harmony because we were choir boys.
That blood harmony thing—that's
so he didn't have to worry about that, and so Harry always would be singing melody, and Steve and I would work out harmonies for it. So we could sing right away, you know, and we sort of did that for all through our school years. My mom wanted us to go to school and get a thing, but we did that, and it was around Brooklyn, around Manhattan, and we were 15 minutes from Greenwich Village, on the subway. High Street, and you jump on there, and you get out West 4th, and there we were. We played the Bitter End. The Hootenannies at the Bitter End and various places, you know.
Absolutely. So, okay, so you sort of around the summer at some point, you end up, of course, you're on Make-A-Wish, you're doing this thing with sharks on a boat. Harry goes to New York, he starts playing shows. He gets into this bidding war with Elektra, with Jack Holzman and Clive Davis. Do you remember this? Did he talk to you? Because these are like two legends in the music industry. When this is going on, we're like, what was happening?
A little backstory was that Harry was very involved with us. We had a band called the Chapins at that point. Steve, myself, Doug Walker, and Phil Forbes, drummer and bass player. And we do electric and acoustic stuff. And we became the house band at the Bitter End. Paul Colby managed us for a year. We opened for everybody, you know, David Steinberg and Randy Newman and Elephant. All kinds of things, you know, all these people, the comedians, you know, and stuff. Every other week we were there. But anyway, Harry was writing for us at that point, and he was working in films. And then he decided to get back. He kept writing these long songs, with long story songs that we didn't fit our thing. So the summer comes, and we're out of school, and we rent the Village Gate, which is another famous club there. And Art DeLugoff, who owned it, gave us, there was a show playing there called Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, the Jacques Brel show. And that was a huge hit. And it went from, I think, 7 to 9. And at 9 o'clock, we got the club on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday for $400 a week. And we could just do it. And we had a review from Rock Magazine that said, the Chapins, the best band I've seen this year. And we made a flag and put it outside, and hopefully a bus of tourists would come or somebody. Our wives and girlfriends did the door, and we were the lead act. And Harry says, "Can I open for you guys?" So I said, "Sure." So he opens the first time and does a half an hour, and it's hard the first week. He didn't know how to do it. The songs were kind of and then we came out and we were a good band, and we just killed, you know. So instead of most people would say, "Oh, it's not going to work," I go away. And Harry says, "I need a band." So he comes. He's living out in Long Beach, Long Island, and I'm living that summer with my mom because I just got back from Blue Water White Death and stuff. Actually, this is later, but I'm at my mom's apartment in Brooklyn. he puts out the call to get some players, and he gets John Wallace, who was in our choir with us, a wonderful singer, who's now a bass player. He's a truck driver. His truck is broken. Okay, I'll play with you. And he gets a guitar player and a cello player. And they spend a week, 2 weeks actually, rehearsing the songs at my mom's house every day. And so Steve and I were part of it. You know, we're there helping him do all that stuff. And okay, now 2 weeks later, he comes back and he opens up a ding, 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 ding. The lights are closed and everybody realizes it. It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night.
Wait. You walk in and he's just playing this, or
no? This is how that in 2 weeks of rehearsing with
he comes up with this.
We knew we'd heard it all in rehearsal, but then so now 2 weeks later, first he does a week. It's terrible, and so we have a couple other people playing for us, and then he comes back.
But does he have the song? And it's the arrangement that we're working.
The arrangement was worked out with the orchestra with a cello. His manager then was Fred Cooley, who would work with the Sherwoods, the great singing group up at Cornell. You know, the a cappella singing group, like
right.
The Whipping Poops and stuff. And Harry was sort of hanging around there. He didn't sing well enough to be in there, but he knew the guys. And Fred, who really, really understood vocals, did a lot of the arranging. Steve, my brother, did a lot of arranging. So did I. We all were there helping Harry invent this thing. And 2 weeks later, he opens up and with a cello, you know, and ding, 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 the finger style thing. The whole thing was there. It was like, whoa, what is this? And by you know, 4 weeks later, and then he gets on the phone with every people, you know, pretending, hi, this is Joe Schmo. I want you to come down and see Harry Chapin at the blah, 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 blah. And he was talked to every end of the summer. They started coming to see Harry, and New York Times gave him a great review. Harry Chapin sings gorgeous love songs. And there was a woman who worked for Jack Holtzman, Ann Pertill, who loved Harry, believed in him totally, and she kept bugging Jack to come see him and do it. So he finally did. Oh, and he gave him an offer. And then Harry wanted Columbia because Clive Davis had Paul Simon and Dylan and, you know, all that stuff. And so that was the place. And so then Clive Davis gives him a bigger thing. And Harry calls up Jack and says, you're going to see all this. You know, there's a documentary coming out this week.
I can't. It's coming out on Friday, right?
And we tell this whole story. It's an amazing story because Jack Holtzman tells it. He says,
wow.
And what he said was, I thought I'd signed Harry. And then Harry calls me and says, I'm going to go with Columbia, which kind of pissed me off. But me and Clive, we've gone through a lot of people. He tried to take Judy Collins away from me. You know, and then he said, so I said to Harry, listen, I'm coming to New York. I'm going to be there at 6:30 a.m. and just expect it. And I'm not leaving until we get some. Harry, bing, ding, ding, 6:30 in the morning on Long Beach, Long Island. There's Jack. And he walks in. And what he offered him at the time was the biggest record deal in history, which not only was it money, but all the recording fees were free.
Wow.
It wouldn't take anything out of him. And he wouldn't release a record the month before, the month of, or the month after. Harry would just be his right there. And that's why Taxi hit, because Taxi, when any other situation, Taxi never would have made it because it was too long, seven minutes, you know.
Right, of course. Except for,
you know, American Pie later on. But you know, but Jack totally believed in it, and they went FM, not singles. They didn't go to AM at all. They went to FM until they got the noise happening. And really, on the pop charts, it did about, I think, 37 or something. Never made a big noise. But it made a career, you know, because anybody who ever heard that song. This great thing about Billy Joel talking about it. He says, man, that song. He says, you know, people used to say that, think I was copying Harry with Piano Man. I used to piss me off, but now I'm proud of that. He's great. Anyway, the documentary is really worth seeing. And it'll be out on Friday. Anybody wants to see it, go to harrychapinmusic.com, I think it's called. Is that right? Let me see. I think it's Harry, but you'll be able to find it.
If not, I'll do a plug at the beginning something for you. So at this point, your brother becomes a millionaire, right? Because he gets the advance. No?
No. There was no, I mean, it all went into the record and then the touring, you know, to go out there. And you're touring when you start, you know, you're opening act for everybody, you know.
Right.
And you have fabulous moments, and you have one where like he went to get airplay, and Harry was great at salesman and went around. But he did something in Houston. It was a big the record company, the station, I think, in Houston, Texas. Harry called me right after this happened, and he said, "So it's a radio station. It's a big rock station. So we're in between the Temptations and Sly and the Family Stone, or something like that." He said, and they're all, boom, 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 you know, and we come out. It was raining hard. He said it was not the best of our audiences, but he also had moments that were just fabulous, you know. And then he gets the Tonight Show,
right? Of course.
And this one,
legendary. He was the first artist to get called back the next night.
Well, what happened was he does Taxi. And they go to, and the place goes nuts. They go to commercial. They come back. The place is still standing and clapping. And so he comes back the next night. They ask him to come back. Yeah, it was legendary stuff. So, you know, it was an amazing kind of, you know, run. Yeah, and we were a part of it all. And then Steve, Harry always sort of felt that we should be part of his thing. You know, he always wanted to play, and I opened for him a lot. And then when he did the Broadway show, Steve and I played with him and were the music directors. And I was his understudy, of course, and he never got sick or anything. So I never did anything. But I was in the band. And then we started touring with him. And I did that for about 6 or 8 months. And then it got to be just, you know, it was just being little brother in this situation. It was like, you know, being, you know, Tommy Cash instead of John. And so I said, I'm just doing my own thing. And it was fine. It was the best thing I could have done. So, but we were very close. And watching the whole thing was pretty amazing, you know.
Wow. Really, yeah. So... your first kids record comes out in 1988, Family Tree, and kind of what we were saying earlier, you had, you know, this realized that there was this gap in the kids music market. And I'm curious, you start performing this record. What kind of confidence does it take to do this? Did people think you were crazy? I guess kids music is kind of associated with folk music, but does it take a lot of confidence to get up there and sing kids songs kind of seriously?
If you had an audience of 4 to 10 year olds and their parents, I always said this was family music, not kids songs. The ones I did a couple of these where they put the kids in the front and the parents sit in the back and talked, and I said never again. So you're going to sit with your kids and we're going to do this together. You know, we're a family and we're a tree, our roots, and it's all about the material. And frankly, this stuff is built for kids. You know, the songs, to go larger, a folk song, what is a folk song? It's a story, many kinds, but largely it's a story song with a singable chorus. Tell you a little story, then we sing this together. And then a little chorus, and we sing this together. That works just the way stories work for anybody. And the question with a kid's record was how to do stories that are clear enough for kids and interesting to kids, but also well-crafted, funny, musically delightful for parents. Right. So that when you're listening to it, we had great budgets. You know, I was with A&M and they gave me, I think, I don't know, 50 grand or something to do a record. And so we could have horns and we could have strings and we could have background singers, and you hired the best bass player, Wayne Petswater, and Richard Crooks, and you know, an electric guitar guy, and John Cobert, who's my longtime collaborator, and all of a sudden, you know, and you realize, oh man, I never had this, you know. And so our idea was to just make great records that were kid friendly and adult safe, and that was the trip. And the answer was no, it was not scary. I've been playing colleges, man. You know, let me tell you, solo doing colleges, I. When in 76, my first adult record came out, and I did the National College Booking Convention. And my brother Jeb, who had been working with Harry at that point as his light man, said, "Well, so you got this thing that's very good. Who's going to run your table?" I said, "My table? Yeah, you got to have a booth to get those kids to come to this thing." He said, "I'll do it for you. I'll tell you what, you give me 50%. I said, "Okay, great." So he got me to, and they said, "Now we need something. You have to." This is interesting. This is the term booking.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, "Now we gotta get something to get these kids to come see you. So let's figure out something." And my wife had a kind of a clothing store, but she had African beads, so we got thongs and an African bead, and made 400 to 600 of them. And if you come to the booth, you get one of these, but only. And Jeb would be there. you got to come see Tom's showcase. Okay, come in. So I can't, they came. They were fired up already. And I did a showcase, and it killed. And so the Southern Convention was going to pick one person. So the Southern part of it. So it was like, I don't know, 70 colleges. And they all, so I suddenly had a tour from August, you know, at freshman week in August to Thanksgiving without every night I had a show in the South. So I flew to down D.C., rented a car, and I came home on Thanksgiving, but I played every night. And let me tell you, that's how you learn to be a performer. Because sometimes you're playing in the lunchroom. Sometimes you're playing Saturday night after a football game, homecoming football game, and everybody's drunk. Sometimes right. you're playing in a little coffee house and there's four people. Sometimes you're playing in a theater and there's 400. Yeah. But I learned how to do the college thing great. You know, just that whole tour. And that, you know, a drunk college kid is a lot like a kid. It's like a child. And so you learn how to move the energy your way. You know, let's do this, you know.
How do you, because I feel like now working in the industry, I always judge an act by their ability to shut up a room. If they can come on stage and everyone can shut up and listen to them, you always think there's something here. And I was rewatching some of your videos and there's moments where like the kids will start talking and you'll just like control the energy and you'll get everyone to listen to you again. How is that? Because you, does that start with the song, with the craft of the song? The song has to be that good, or how do you do that?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, it's really, you learn it for one thing, and but always have something, you know. I call it getting through the neck of the bottle. You know, there's this thing you want to get to this place, and there's this little place to get through, and so that you find a way to go. How to do it, you know, and there's ways to get interested. You have tried and true things, but the material is the biggest thing. Because if I go up there and sing, you know, "Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man" to a group of kids, after about the you know, the fourth or fifth line, they're going to go, "I don't know what this means." But if you say, "Mikey took my truck and he broke it, then he turned to me and said, 'So what?' So I said, 'Say you're sorry.' But he won't say sorry. No, he won't say sorry, because I'm not." You got him. Or, "This is a song, it's an old story about a dinosaur." Pretty new song. "A stegosaurus in the forest, munching on some hay, lay down to snooze in a bed of ooze and sadly..." You find a way to get through the neck of the bottle, get something that's really interesting for, you know, and try, and that's part of the trick. Clear songs about interesting stuff. I mean, there's so many things. I open a school show with, hey, you walk out and there's 1,000 kids from schools. So this doesn't happen now in the pandemic, but it used to be. In the 90s, I was playing all these schools. And you walk out and you go, "Look at all you guys. How'd you get here? How many of you walked here? You know, how many of you had your parents drive here? How many of you came here in a big yellow banana? You know, how many of you came in a big yellow balloon? How many of you came in a big yellow bus?"
And then you've got,
"Hear it come around the corner, big and yellow and loud. Can't you hear it?"
Pick up the school bus crowd.
Yeah, you know, and that's what you do all through the show. And after you've done a couple just singing songs, you say, "Okay, this is a song with no instruments." You talk about the banjo. You know, "This is an interesting story. What is this? Look at this. It's a drum with a stick and strings. You know where it comes from? You know, Africa. You know, and the same thing with the guitar and the auto harp. And then you say, "Let's do something with just our hands and our voices. Put your right hand up, left hand up. Boom. Alphabet soup. We have dabba-doo-doo. You know, grabs a letter, throw it, family tree." So you just find things that are action, and you teach them how to sing along, and you teach them all this stuff. And it worked for the very first time I did it, but you get better at it, you know, because the material, I totally believe in the material, and the material is boffo. You know, you got, the best thing I ever did was ask John Forster to help me write the first record. And you check him out, Entering Marion, some of his. He's a theater writer, but a wonderful writer. What he taught me was the thing that most folk guys don't learn, except some of them, is don't take the pen away too soon. You know, he said, because I'm used to, you get a song close, let me go out and sing it to you. And then you sort of find by singing it, which works. No. He's a theater writer. It goes to something, it's going to be there. Let's look at this. How about this? And that really helped me enormously. A lot of ways helped me, but I really learned how to write in terms of the craft of fixing it. You know, the first thing is inventing it. Oh, this is cool, you know. Sing a whale song, sing a whale song. How cool. And then we want to make each of those verses rhyme in there just so I punchline. On a fateful day in the month of May, I was sitting catching fish when a magic whale swam up to the rail and said, please make a wish. So all those little rhymes go pump, pump, pump all the way through, tell a story. He says, let me take this home and just, you know, fix those rhymes. And so, and that was like, ding, ding, ding. You know, you learn from the best. And I have had this wonderful collaborators, you know, and you keep learning, and it's like, and it's helped my adult stuff as well. So, and it's also helped my adult performance as well. You know, because of the college stuff, I used to do a lot of shtick when I was doing an adult show, and now I have so much better material. I can just tell a story and let lead it through, and then tell this, and then do a thing. Then you know, you learn how to.
Do you take those elements of, like, you know, you put them in an adult context, but the elements of like explaining what a banjo is, or like catching them in the beginning with a line. Does that transfer in ways to the adult shows?
It does. You don't have to do the shtick, but
you the same it. Way, of course. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and also I learned that people really are interested in the story of. They paid money to come see you, and so I've played with many artists who just, but I Harry was the same way, and I'm the same way. There's a wonderful thing happening if you get them involved in the story, and this is, you know, this is interesting how this happened. And then he goes leading the song and help me with the chorus, and all of a sudden you're in this, as opposed to, you know, a little guy standing up there. All of a sudden, you're talking to people, and that's a wonderful thing. In some ways, that's what I really adore about a show. You said, you know when you sing a song, and it's like, you know, and as much as it is when it's, you know, rocking. But when you get them to really follow through there, where they're, you know.
Are you like, because I'm sure that there are nights that are better than others in terms of the audience. If you find a group of kids that are just really crazy, you can't get them together, are you hard on yourself, or do you go, they're just kids, what do they know?
Oh, I think you're always you're very aware of what, how it worked or didn't work, and you try to figure, was there something I could have done? I remember playing. I used to play this in Pittsburgh, the Children's Festival, and they always put me in an auditorium that had so much echo in it, just by naturally.
Yeah,
it was really hard. You know, it's a war kind of thing, and it was always so much harder. People liked it, but it was much harder to get stuff because it was sort of this soup going whoa, and that was the hardest stuff. And the other thing that's really hard is if nothing comes back. You know, if it's the first time I played Canada, it was like, whoa, they were so polite. You know, having grown up in New York City, you know, and doing stuff, and the island, you know, and around the tri-state area. But I learned that was great, but sometimes it's like, hello, you know?
Yeah.
You're not used to that. You're used to having this going on, and you bounce off that, you know?
Right. So, okay. So speaking of kind of like a little bit of the writing process and working with John Forster. So like this Pretty Planet, for example, when you're writing that song, do you have that progression? Do you start with that progression, or do you think, hey, we need to write a song about the world? Like how does that song come together?
We started with that recording, which is Family Tree. I approached John and said, I want to do a kids record. So what do I do? And as we discussed it in the first thing, we said, let's use the folk forms. And one of the folk forms is around. And I used to do that with my girls in the car, because it would, you know, there'd be somebody, they'd be fighting in the back. Let's go By the waters of Babylon, even and you know, singing back and forth, you know, and so we said it was maybe we could do a round, and then John came up with this great the first line. This pretty planet spinning through space, you're a garden, you're a harbor, you're a holy place. I went, wow. It was right at the end of the session. And I went home and said, we're gonna do this tomorrow. And I wrote the tune to that. You know, and it was like but I remember, and then we came back and then we finished it, you know. This pretty planet spinning through space, you're a garden, you're a harbor, you're a holy place. And that chord progression can go through the whole thing. And he and I together worked out how to make the rest of it work. And what the way, and that song, you know, that's going to outlive me, you know, and outlive John. It's, I tell you what, Zach, you go on, just say, go on YouTube and say This Pretty Planet, you'll find thousands of those, especially in the pandemic, because every teacher who has to do a song.
Oh, I know.
From far away is puts that up, and we're going to do this song now. And Claudia every morning sends me another one or two or three or four. And so it's astonishing. And it's amazing how a song like that in a kid's record. But it did go around the world once. You know, it's one of the songs used to wake up the astronauts on the Discovery 7 space shuttle. We woke up John Glenn on that space shuttle. That was the one. One of the publicity team said, maybe we can have each of the astronauts pick a song to have. And somebody picked, you know, It's a Wonderful Life by Satchmo. And the pilot's wife had three kids, and she had my tape. And she said, Pretty Planet, you got to do that. And so he did. And I didn't know it was going to happen. They didn't mention it at all. But I was on the road that weekend. It was a Sunday morning they did it. And I get home and I had on my, and I didn't, before cell phones, you know, I get home and my whole answering machine was totally full. Hey, did you hear hey, Tom, yeah, Pretty. Cause it was a publicity thing for them, you know. And then later on, I mean, it's happened so many times with that song. Christopher Reeve, the actor who had the terrible accident and was paralyzed. Played
Superman,
and I was about to play down in Princeton, and his mother, he grew up in Princeton, his mother was there, and Claudia at my office says, calls me up and says, I just got a call from someone who says they're Christopher Reeve's mother. And he's coming to the concert tomorrow and wanted to know if Dana, his wife, could sing Pretty Planet because it's their favorite song with you, do the Judy Collins part. I'm not sure if it's, I said, Claudia, say yes, you know. So it happened. She happened to be a wonderful singer as well as an actress. And so we're doing the show, and she, I tell her it'll be right after Family Tree. And so she knows what to do. So I'm starting doing a show. It's a daytime show, and it's totally full. We used to play there all the time. And in somewhere in the second song, after he's in there, I see them wheeling him in the back with the giant. He was 6'5", my big tall, you know, this giant gurney. And I'm like, okay, go on, I forget about it. Then we fit in Family Tree, and I look over in there, and on the side, there's Dana and their boy. So she came out and sang it with us. Just did the Judy Collins part, and it was just amazing. And then afterwards, we hung out after I, you know, I go out and sign stuff, and then and they waited, and I spent 45 minutes with Chris and his wife, and
wow.
They said how much the song had meant to him and to them during this time. And you say, whoa, this is a magical thing that you know, this song that we loved and we wrote, and you throw out there, and it goes out in ways that you don't dream it's going to do, but you're thrilled.
Absolutely. Okay. I have a couple other like nerdism things that I've always kind of wondered.
Sure.
Street Fair, there's that little rap in the middle where you start like going off with the foods at the street fair. Do you write a whole bunch of foods out and kind of see what rhymes and kind of what fits? How do you come up with that little section? Because that section always freaked me out.
Well, Michael, that was Michael, Mark, and I. And we did street fair. And well, we just had to, you know, he's amazing in terms of just coming up with all kinds of arcania and things and funny things. But that one, I think we just, we were, the two of us were riffing there, sitting at the table. It's grown men playing, you know, we're at a table, and, you know, in my kitchen, you know, in the morning, he would come over about 9:45 and leave by my lunch, you know, and we'd see no more. And so we're just firing through on this whole thing. I've had the street fair and the stuff, and we were at a point in the record where we were really firing together. It was really, you know, first few days is always like, and then you start, and then it starts like this. So it was just bubbling, you know. So what else in the street fair? Oh, I always love this. Okay, blah, 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 blah. And so I don't even remember, but I know how, that's how we did it. I mean, for instance, the other one is Gertie's Birdseed Diner. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
And that was Michael and my, and you know, there's a, it's a song about this bird, the bird feeder is a birdseed diner. And the way that happened was Michael is there at 10 in the morning. He goes, I've been here 3 days in a row and the same birds come in at the same time. It's like a diner. And I said, diner? Hey, a birdseed diner. He's Gertie's Birdseed Diner. Boom, you know, and then hear the cackle of the grackle in the moaning of the dove and the mockingbird are rocking from the branch above and the catbird sitting in the catbird seat says, pull up, perch and eat. Hear a Nashville warbler sing a country song and all the birdies at the counter are chirping along. They go flap, 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 tweet, tweet, tweet at Gertie's Birdseed Diner. You know, the bluebird special. So we, and that one, we pulled out the, you know, the bird thing and said, okay, who comes to this diner?
Right. I was re-listening to that song last night and I never connected with the Nashville line. And now I was thinking about that now. I was like, now I'm in Nashville.
I love that there was a Nashville warbler. I thought that, you know, I never heard of it, you know, and yeah. Looking at the bird, hey, Mike, there's a Nashville warbler. Nashville warbler, pull up a perch and eat.
Yep.
So it is, it is that joy of playing with these things where you get a smile out of it. And I think, and the street fair is one of those where we just went for it. We live in the Rockin County, you know, and there's lots of street fairs that happen. And there's one in Nyack up the road here.
And I grew up in Hastings on Hudson. So,
oh yeah. So you know exactly where.
So I'm right there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, we were just sort of visualizing and following that through the whole deal there. I don't, that was a very kind of a full-throated album that we just kind of worked all of the songs very quickly and very happy with them, but it was interesting. We got on a flow there, so it's hard to remember that specifically. Some of the early ones, which you took a little longer and just sort of inventing it, you tend to remember more.
Is there a song that you wish you could play for Harry, if there was one of your kids' songs or one song that was special that you wish you could have the opportunity to play for him?
Oh, there's a bunch, actually. The one, the Hunger at one, I would have loved to play for him. In 5/4, there's enough for everyone. Father, daughter, mother, son, there's enough for everyone in our green and growing home. And it's pretty planet. And there's a bunch of, I think he would have loved, you know, Cousins. And from the desert to the plain, from the mountain to the plain, there's enough for everyone in our green and growing home. Everyone, no matter who, there's a place reserved for you. There's enough for everyone in our green. What else? Let's see. I mean, there's so many of the story songs. Cousins, he would have loved. I kind of like some of the crazy ones, like Borneo. You know,
that is my favorite song of yours. That is my favorite Tom Chapin song. It really is. That is the one I always listen to because it's an adventure song.
It is. It just goes rocking, you know. And what I love about that one is it's so kid-like in the fact that you don't worry about the logic of it. You know, they're taking a bike ride and they go and everything had to end with O, you know, Chicago, Reno, Borneo. Of course, it's from Borneo, I got a friend, his name is Joe. That's me and Michael, man. We just riffed on that. It was just so much fun. I always had some place to go. I called him up, you want to play? No, you and I are going away. Today's the day, says my friend Joe.
We're going
to
go to
Barney. To Borneo. Chit-a-dong,
chit-a-dong. That's a great like Pete Townsend moment right there.
It is. It is. And I had the best players. That was just great fun to play, you know, and to invent this thing. And then to go in the studio with these guys who just can make it live, you know. I listened back just recently to This Pretty Planet and listening to Richard Crook's drumming and Pet's Water, both who are now gone, and I miss him dearly. But Richard Crook's had that kind of Ringo joy of playing, but with great chops, you know.
Yeah.
And he just like he just made you know just then they came in and just made these things go like this, just you know, and you could just ride on it, and it was so much fun, you know.
Now
the other ones is the whole Bruno Chronicles. Harry would have liked those.
Absolutely. So I know we're running a little short on time, but I also really wanted to ask, do you remember hearing Cat's Cradle for the first time? And I'm curious, do you think Harry was a good judge of his work? Because I've heard the story that he didn't pick that song. Jack Halsman was the one who picked that single. Do you think Harry knew how talented he was, or do you think it was a little lost on him?
Oh, I think he knew how talented he was, but he was also never one to, it was always about when in doubt, do something, you know? So he'd write it and then let's get it done. And that's the next one. And he was not one to sort of sit there and say, you know, just revel in this. It was always about moving forward. And Cats started as a poem Sandy wrote about her first husband and his father, and then Harry took it and made a tune out of it. But he didn't think it was a hit record, or even a single. And Jack was fought with him, and Harry said, "Okay, you'll give me another chance to when this dies, right?" He said, "Yeah." And then of course goes to number one. So I got a call from him. He was on the road. He goes, "Tom, Cats is number one in Billboard, Cashbox, and what if I forget the third, all three." And you know what all I'm thinking about? I said, "What? How do I follow it up?" He said, "This is a bitch, man. You know, it's got to be going, not the getting there that's good. Because you get here and all you say, oh man, how am I going to, you know, now this is what I expected. Right. How am I going to get another one?" And he never did, of course, but it was really interesting to hear that from him, you know, was that thought. And by the end, he was also really involved in the hunger issue.
Right, of course.
He loved performing and stuff, but the writing wasn't here. The writing was here at the end. And but what a song that is. I mean, that song, I've done it many times, it's a true song, no matter who you are, what kind of child you were, what kind of child you are, what kind of parent you are, what kind of, you know, it's just a true song. And very few songs are that true. You know, some love songs are and stuff, but that one just the way Billy Joel in the quotes Taxi, said, just the way in Taxi at the end where she hands him a $20 bill and another man might have been angry, another man might have been hurt, another man never would have let it go. I stashed a bill in my shirt. And Billy Joel in the film goes, "That's true." He says, "I don't know if it's true, but it's true."
Right.
You know? He said, "I got chilled, man. I mean, I heard that." I said, "Man, you know, that's the best." And Harry's best stuff was as good as anybody's, you know. But I think he was also too quick to, you know, Paul Simon, Bruce take a lot of time and really craft, and don't let something out unless it's, you know. And Harry was, "That's it. Let's go. Next one." You know, and busy doing a lot of stuff. And I think that hurts. That hurts some of the songs, but as I say, the best stuff is like, whew, you know. And he was a very good critic too. I know that as a younger brother, because he would. At one point, he said, "You got to write a second record," and you know, and I don't know. He said, "Well, just bring me your stuff." And so I went out there for about four nights in a row with stuff, and this needs blah, 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 this needs this, you know. And he did a whole actually. Sandy sent me a thing. He was doing some songwriting things, and they somebody sat down and recorded it all and wrote them out. Interesting stuff. Maybe we can find a way to get that out there sometimes. But
wow, yeah. And I also didn't realize, and I learned this last night, that I Want to Learn a Love Song is a true story. Yeah. Which to me I thought was funny, because that almost seems like the least likely to be true out of all of his hits.
Yeah, yeah. It was the way he met Sandy, you know, that he had well, he was not one to have to stand on truth, but that one was true. You know,
right.
you just follow the good story, you know, and he would know that. Harry, who was often untruthful, but always interesting, you know, let's not let truth get in the way of a good story here, you know.
Absolutely, which means it's totally different.
Actually, it was almost a true story in the sense that he got a hack license and was about to drive. Did you ever hear this story?
No, please tell me. Yeah.
So he's working in documentary films. He can't. It's the first Nixon recession. Can't get a job. He has an apartment to pay for, and he's okay. So he takes out a hack license in New York City. It's Friday night. Monday night, he's going to get the cab from midnight to 8 a.m. or something, whatever it is. And all weekend, he's lying in bed, go, what happens if, in the thing, it's Sue, but her name is Claire. His girlfriend from, he had a girlfriend who was the daughter of Eastern Airlines, a real rich girl. And we always took subway. We're New York City kids, you know, and her parents said, here's money. Never take a subway. Take a cab. It's dangerous in the subway. I know that Harry guy, but you just, you know. So he's thinking, what happens if Claire gets in my cab? What am I going to say here? And on Monday, he got two offers for films. And so he took them, never drove. But the story was there. It was right in his head. And he started writing that story. That story right then. And he sang it to us. And we didn't quite hear it until he put the whole arrangement together. You know, he wanted us to sing it, and it was like, it needed a guy just to sit there and tell you the story and the way he did. So, The Baby Never Cries. That's another one that on the first record that was a true story of one of his girlfriends who had a husband had broken up and he would visit her at night and the baby and never saw the baby, you know, and that became a song. So wow. The early ones were kind of those kind of things, but he was actually writing a lot of poetry before that too. That's one of the reasons those songs are so erudite and so clear. He was very involved with trying to, he thought he may, Sandy said, I thought I was going to marry a poet who had no money and never would have money, you know, and then it turns out, whoa, the shooting star, you know.
Right.
So
that's so cool. Tom, this has been such a thrill. I feel like this hour flew by. This was so fun.
Thank you so much.
Before I let you run, you've so graciously played the banjo a couple times. Can I trouble you for one more song before you run?
Let me get a guitar out, play something. All right, had to go get the guitar.
Which guitar is this? Can I just ask quickly?
This is a Grit Laskin guitar. Grit Laskin from Canada, with a wonderful inlay guy.
Who does amazing inlay work.
Yeah, he made. I asked him for, he says a month before I was done, he said, the guitar is done. What do you want on the peg head? And I said, I don't know. How about a blues guy? So he said, oh, that's interesting. So he went he's in Toronto. So he goes to the Toronto Library and gets a picture of some unknown blues guy.
Yeah.
And puts this on there. We were talking to Reverend Gary Davis, you know, it's like, oh, I got the wrong finger pick on here. Got my banjo pick on. Let's see. The song I first heard with Reverend Gary Davis was
Thanks to the River.
Lord, I have a whole lot of trouble trying to get home. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see.
I've used this on a couple of that kind of ragtime picking on a couple of things. Here, I'll do one of the kids' things. A stegosaurus in the forest munching on some hay lay down to snooze in a bed of ooze and sadly passed away. Her body changed and rearranged as she sank beneath the soil. An old Mine, she turned to slime and then she turned to oil. So she disappears for a jillion years till finally she is found by a guy named Bill with an oil drill who sucks her from the ground. Bill pipes that poor old dinosaur to an oil refinery where they bubble and boil and change that oil into stuff for you and me. REC by CLE. That's the way it's supposed to be. The earth recycles, and so do we. RECYCLE. You want to see me playing? I'll do a little bit here. Move it back a little bit so you see the guitar. Now, from the late Jurassic, it's fantastic how our dino friend has now become petroleum, and still that's not the end. From dino juice, they now produce a million plastic jugs and stegosaurus drinking straws, stegosaurus mugs, RECYCLE. That's the way it's supposed to be. The earth recycles, and so do we. RECYCLE. Play one. Walking up, walking down. That's the way the system works. Things don't disappear. We turn sand into window glass and roots into root beer. We cut and mine, we refine and make these things, and then use them not just once, not just twice, but again and again and again and again and again. And if a dinosaur could see us pouring orange juice this way from a plastic jug we made of her, well, this is what she'd say. It took me 80 million years to get to you today. So don't throw that mug, don't throw that jug, don't you throw me away. RECYCLE. That's the way it's supposed to be. We're just a link in the chain of history. RECYCLE. RECYCLE. That's the way that's supposed to be. Hey, I recycle this melody. RECYCLE. Use it again. RECYCLE. And again. RECYCLE.
The master, Tom Chapin. Oh my God, that is so good.
Thank you, Zach. Tom, great fun talking to you.
Thank you so much. That was an absolute blast. Thank you so much. So appreciative. Stay well out there, and
thank
I'll see you on the YouTube.
Be well.
There you have it, episode 31. Thanks for tuning in. This episode really meant a lot to me. I mean, it was so cool talking with Tom. This is the first time we'd ever spoken, actually. We've never met before. And I mean, the power of music, it's amazing that I can talk with him and listen to him play, and I'm transported right back to being 5 years old and watching him play live on my TV and struggling along on my guitar to play along and listening to his music on airplanes and seeing him live in concert. I mean, just this meant a lot to me, and I really appreciate you guys tuning in and checking it out. And I hope you guys got something from it. And by the way, the movie, the Harry Chapin movie that's out now, the documentary, you got to check this out. You can go to harrychapinmovie.com to learn more about it, figure out how to watch it. And it's an incredible film. I think you're really going to love it. So please check out the Harry Chapin documentary. And thanks again to Tom for coming on the show and taking the time to help promote the movie. And I mean, it was so much fun talking, and I'm so glad we were able to make it happen. So thanks again, Tom. Thanks again for listening. I'm Zach Kuhn, and we'll see you next week. Bye.